Call the Senate Tax Committee to order for February 3rd, 2015. Thank you, members. There's a quorum present. Members, Senator Rest is not able to be with us today. Senator Limmer is a co-author on that bill. So we are going to do Senate File 129, Senator Rest bill first, and then we'll move on to Senator Limmer's bill, property tax refund income definition. But we'll start with Senator Rest, Senate File 129. Senator Limmer, thank you for picking this up for Senator Rest. I understand you had conversations with her, and she's not able to attend today. So.
Glad Senator to be Limmer. Here, Mr. Chairman and members. Senate File, I don't even know what the Senate File is. The bill before you.
Senate File 129.
The bill before you is a simple adjustment on the percentage that would be recognized in the event that your property taxes would exceed a certain percentage amount and be available for a refund. The property tax refund program, currently you recognize your normal tax and you apply for a refund oftentimes in the fall of the year. But this is the targeted, some people might call it special, it might be the targeted application of how a refund, if it exceeds a certain amount of increase. Right now we recognize a 12% increase. One would be available for an additional refund back to the taxpayer. Senator Rest's bill changes the 12% simply to a 10%, so it would allow for more tax relief to a greater number of people that may have experienced a sizable increase in their property taxes. The bill is rather straightforward. And the dollar amount does have to at least exceed $100. There's no change in that. It's just the percentage.
And, Senator Limmer, we had a little conversation before the committee about if there was any income criteria on this targeting. There is not. It is simply a percentage of property tax increase year to year.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Questions, members? And we do not have anyone on our testifier list, but is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify in favor or against Senate File 129? There is a...
That's for Tommy.
Okay. Any questions, members?
Mr. Chair, you may have seen there's a fiscal note. I think it's in your packet or it might be being passed out now. It appears to be a rather modest dollar amount impact to help you with your decision.
Well, and Senator Limmer, to that point, that is an indication of the number of property taxes that had an increase of the change from 10 to 12. I think that there are some issues with regard to participation in this program. It's considerably lower than we would like for a statewide program. I don't know if it's partly because people are unaware of it, but significantly less than half of the people who would qualify for this program are participating in it. So we're going to take a look at some of those issues, too, as we go through the legislation discussion. The other thing, you know, we really don't have a, you know, we haven't had any discussion about whether if 10% is the actual number that we should be shooting for, that any individual would pay for 100% of the property tax increase or not. So there are a number of factors that we will be considering as we work on this legislation. But I appreciate you bringing it forward for Senator Rest today. Seeing no further
questions.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Skoy. I think this is a good step in the right direction. I have a question on it is for homestead property taxes. And I'd like to know the history, if we have done anything similar in regard to commercial property taxes. So the state general property tax on commercial properties.
I think the answer is no, but let's turn to Mr. Sylvia.
Mr. Chair and Sarah Nelson, I'm not aware of any program that's similar to this where there's a targeted program directed at commercial industrial property from 1 year to the next. Increased taxes.
That's something that I'm going to examine. Won't go forward with that today. But I will say that commercial property taxes have also escalated dramatically in some cases. For example, my office property tax went up over 20% in 1 year. And so I'm just saying that's something we should consider going forward.
Seeing nothing else, Chair will lay Senate File 129 over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much, Senator Limmer.
Thank you.
Senator Limmer, Senate File 226, property tax refunds. And do you have a testifier you'd like to join?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 226 addresses the subject of how we apply scholarships to income for certain tax purposes. You might know that scholarships, when a student gets a scholarship, that scholarship dollar amount is not considered taxable income when we compute our taxes at the end of each year. However, it's a little different when we're considering that scholarship dollar amount. The state considers it as income for the computing of our tax refund sometimes in the fall. And so it seems to be a difference. You know, the federal government recognizes scholarships as non-taxable income. I believe the state recognizes it as when we apply it to normal income. But when it comes to a tax refund, we add it in, and oftentimes that becomes a taxable event for the taxpayer, or certainly adjusts property tax refund less because of that scholarship dollar amount. I have a constituent of mine from the Maple Grove area, Mr. Andrew Shedlock, who discovered this himself in his journey through his schooling. And he's here to give us a little insight of how this particular tax policy has affected him.
Senator Limmer, I think that there's the A1 amendment.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Amendment.
Thank you for pointing that out. I have an author's amendment. The A1 amendment may be before you at this time. I hope everyone has received it. This is a technical amendment, a little more comfort language to make it very specific to the intent of the
Senator article. Reinhart moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those same sign, motion prevails. The A1's adopted. Senator Limmer.
And, Ms. Chair, I'd like to again renew my introduction of Mr. Shedlock.
Welcome to the Tax Committee, Mr. Shedlock, and state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Andrew Shedlock. I want to thank you for having me here today, and I want to thank Senator Limmer for introducing this bill. Like Senator Limmer said, I am a resident of Maple Grove along with my wife. I'm testifying today as a private citizen representing no group or other interest. The way that I became to come aware of this issue is I received a very nice Christmas present in early December, an early Christmas present, when I was told that through whatever sort of inadvertent omission from a 2011 property tax filing that my wife and I made, that there had been omitted a scholarship that I had received to attend law school. And because I had omitted that the state would like to have approximately $850 back from the property tax refund that my wife and I received in fiscal year 2011, or for the tax year 2011. And I was a little surprised by this, considering that, as the senator said, the scholarships, grants, and tuition discounts are not taxable income. But in conversations with the Department of Revenue and various research, I learned that they were counted as household income, I guess it would be the proper term. And I came to learn that the state considers household income as part of your ability to shoulder or to handle a property tax burden. And I was a little concerned with this because, as graduate students who were fortunate enough to receive scholarships in the year 2011. I can assure you that myself and I'm sure other students were, while we were fortunate, it's not like we had a significant source of outside revenue when you're attending school full time. So your ability to handle a property tax burden may look like you can on paper, but I would just argue that that wasn't the case for us, and I assume for others. And I think this bill is a common sense approach to a problem. Obviously now, as my wife and I are working professionals who have benefited from our graduate school careers, we're more than happy to handle a property tax burden just like anyone else. But I think that students who are fortunate enough to receive scholarships, grants, and tuition discounts going forward are exactly the types of people that we would want to reward and help out. I know the revenue note indicates a modest decrease in revenue to the state. However, I think that putting that money in the hands of hardworking students is only a good thing for them. And finally, I just note that obviously this bill won't affect or impact or benefit my wife and I. We're long done with graduate school. This is something that I brought to the senator's attention because I think it's the right way to approach the issue. This seems to be the year of higher education. Lots of proposals both in the state and nationally to give benefits and discounts to community college students, to college students in general. I think it's a great group of people to benefit. It's a great group of people to give just a little bit of relief to, and then in the hopes that they can use that money to pay down credit card debt they may have incurred for books, use that money for a potential down payment on a home as we did, or use that money to have a little more debt relief, because the average student loan burden in Minnesota is a significant number, and just benefiting those students in that way seems like the appropriate thing to do moving forward. So thank you for your assistance and your having me here, and I just really thank Senator Limmer for introducing this bill.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. When you receive your scholarship, was that money that flowed into your accounts that you could use in any manner, or were they dedicated for your education, or how flexible was that those dollars? And part of the point here is there are a number of incomes that are added back in qualifying for the PTR, and it's trying to get at your total availability of resources. And so how flexible were those monies to you?
For my situation in particular, Mr. Chair, that money flowed directly to my school. I never received any cash or check. That money was just a scholarship, 100% controlled by the school.
Okay, thank you. Any questions, members?
Mr. Chairman, I might add that Mr. Shedlock's story applied to graduate and law school application, but the intent of this particular bill would apply toward any scholarship, even in a undergraduate study program, so it widens the field a little bit, not just for anyone going to law school. It goes to anyone that would be experiencing any help in the form of a scholarship, even in their BA application.
Sure, and Senator Limmer, when we're reading this bill, there are seven or eight or six where you're adding back, and then there are also a number of provisions that do not include income. So, we'll have to try to balance that out and see if this is one of those criteria that should be, while it's being removed from one list and kind of by default would be added to the other one. But any questions? Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing this forward. I am intrigued by it. One of the questions I have, and I think this is what Senator Scoy was getting at, was, and it's more of a question maybe for staff to look at and people to consider, can we separate out money that, like in your situation, that went directly to the school that you have no, you have no control over, versus money where people get, where they have some flexibility in determining if it's used for, rent, and in some cases all of their money goes to pay rent, versus in some cases it might go to, you know, other things, some of which may be needed and some of which, you know, where people may have a disagreement on, is that really, you know, needed? So I don't know if we can separate that out at all if we're looking at this to, and as we, you know, get towards the end of the crunch of where we're having a discussion on how much do we have and how much can we parse out, because I think this is, especially in this case where you have no control over it, it goes directly to the school. If we're looking at students from across the state, that we're one of the states that, for whatever reason, people leave with a lot of debt, especially in like medical school and veterinarian school, where we're really kind of pushing people into those areas, especially in underserved populations where we need them. So I think it is intriguing, but I would like to know, just from a dollar perspective, can we separate that out? So it might be a fiscal note question. Can we separate it out so that how much would we be talking about if we're just looking at money that goes directly to schools versus how much money if there's flexibility? And I know that is kind of an iffy question, because a lot of times people get money and it goes directly to them and it all goes right to the school and to pay their rent. So it is kind of a, you know, throw your arms up question.
Senator Dietzig, I think that's one of the questions that would be answered. The other is the question that we always struggle with in this committee is, you know, we're going to do a tax change that's going to benefit individuals. Are there other ways that those resources can be used more effectively?
Right.
And so, you know, these are some of the questions that we'll be looking at. Senator Limmer?
Mr. Chair, being a former member of this committee for a few years, I certainly know the need to scrutinize the bill. And in this discussion, I recognize the need, as Senator Dietzig has brought up, the need to perhaps qualify the application of the scholarships to determine its true purpose after the student receives it. It's being used for perhaps a more personal reason, then that should probably be subject to an income application. But if the money is going directly to an educational institution, or perhaps for books or other learning supplies, then we could recognize that. I think that would be rather simple for the tax committee to recognize the legitimate expenses and purposes of a scholarship, and then that would be applied to the formula for application on a tax property refund. I know the tax committee is very thorough in how they analyze bills. We have a few months to kick this around and determine if we can give students a little more help.
And Senator Limmer, Senator Dietzig, Ms. McQuay, you had something to add?
Mr. Chair and members, the stricken language references non-taxable scholarship or fellowship grants, and the IRS defines tax-free only to the extent that it does not exceed your expenses. It is not designated or earmarked for other purposes, such as room and board, and it does not require that it can be used for that it cannot be used for qualified education expenses, and it does not represent payment for teaching, research, or other services. So it only represents the non-taxable piece is the part that is for expenses. For those fellowships that pay essentially for fellowships or for research or for teaching assistance or for general expenses beyond what is required for the education, that would be included in the starting point of FAGI. So this bill just strikes the reference to the non-taxable piece, to the dedicated part to the education expenses. If you wanted to go further and exempt or take away from income the piece that is over and above the expenses, you'd have to make an additional a subtraction from FAGI for that. And that comes in the form of a 1099.
And so, Ms. McQuay, the way this definition of non-taxable is, this would apply only to the education expenses.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Or the expenses required. So anything required by, if you're required to live on campus and you get a scholarship for that, that would be required.
Any other questions, members? Anybody in the audience would like to testify against this bill? Seeing none, anything else, Senator Limmer? Thank you for traveling today. Thank you, Senator Limmer. Chair will lay Senate file 226 over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
And members, we have two bills that are the same. I think they're identical, actually. They're certainly the same concept. Senate file 208, Senator Latz, and Senate file 313, Senator Schmidt. If those two senators would come to the table, and we'll present these bills together. The list of testifiers is the same for both bills. So why don't we start with a correction in the motion for Senate file 226. It's laid over as amended. Senator Latz, you have the lower number, Senate file 208. Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I appreciate the opportunity to bring this bill before the committee. This bill is a reprise, both on my part and on the part of the legislative advocates in favor of this approach to preserving and replenishing the property tax base and the housing stock and hopefully also the commercial stock in a community. In 1993, this legislature passed the original This Old House legislation. At the time, Representative Jim Rhodes, who was my state representative at that time, was heavily involved. I don't recall specifically if he was the chief author of the bill or not, but he certainly was a strong advocate here and in my community in St. Louis Park. I was on the city council a year after that, and we did a lot of focus in our community on taking important steps to maintain the quality of an aging housing stock. St. Louis Park is a fully developed community, as is Hopkins and portions of Golden Valley that I now represent. But at the time, you know, we were known, and we still are, for having a strict housing code enforcement. And the purpose of that was when houses get sold, it was to make sure that they were brought up to code. So we had that incentive. If there ever was an incentive to force people to make sure their housing stock was maintained, that was it. And because of that, even though we have many, many homes that were developed in the late 1800s and then very substantially right after World War II for the returning GIs, we've maintained a substantial quality housing stock. What we have found was that there would be an advantage also to having a strict financial incentive to doing that. And so I introduced this bill originally in 2011 to reauthorize what had expired, this old House bill that had expired in its authorization. And at that time, Representative Simon carried the bill in the House, also from St. Louis Park and Hopkins. And now we're back again because we think it's very important for communities like mine, and as you'll hear from other communities around the state, to have a financial incentive in place for owners of their property to reinvest in their property. It has the impact of stabilizing communities, of stabilizing homes and families, of maintaining the quality of the physical facilities around a community. And that I don't have to go into long policy detail about why that's important. I'm sure this committee is well versed in that. But expanding that concept beyond residential also to commercial would have the same benefits for Main Street, and for maintaining stable job locations within a community also. So that's the bill that you have before you today. I do want to express my appreciation to the members of this committee that have co-authored my Senate file, Senators Cohen, Thompson, and Dietzick. I want to give Senator Schmidt an opportunity also. We share the same priorities here, and we ask the committee to support.
Thanks, Senator Latz. Senator Schmidt.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to reiterate the message that you heard from Senator Latz here. He, of course, did beat me to the punch on this bill, but I've heard from constituents up and down the River Corridor in southeastern Minnesota and throughout my district and elsewhere that the challenges of an aging housing stock are just as real in rural Minnesota as they are in our metropolitan area. And the promise and the opportunity with this sort of incentive program could result in just as many benefits in greater enrollment in Minnesota as they could in our metropolitan area. So with that said, I know that we have a lot of great testimony before us today, and I know that in my hometown of Red Wing and also down the river in Lake City in Wabasha, we have a great opportunity with century homes, homes that are over 100 years old, that we're trying to create some incentives for additional investment and in shoring up that housing stock, property values, and our tax base. And so whether it's this mechanism or another, we really feel the need for doing more to incent further investment. So with that said, I'd just like to reiterate what you heard from Senator Latz, and of course, I'd stand for any questions.
Thank you. And before we go to testifiers, I'm not going to get into why 30 years instead of 45 and these things, but there are just a couple of fundamental questions that I think we need to ask, and maybe the testifiers will help answer that, or you guys can help answer that. But, I mean, why do we want to take and shift this cost of improving one person's home onto everybody else in the community? Because this is what this does. It's a shift of property tax onto everybody else, and you're kind of taking those that have the ability to remodel their home or already, and already have, and taking that growth off the property tax base that everybody else will have to pick up a little more. And so we want to understand if that truly is the benefit for the community. CI is a business, and as you remodel your business, hopefully you're going to have more returns and therefore would have wherewithal to help the community deal with the services that your business needs. And then finally, the last time this provision was in law, it built up to where there was around $700 million of tax shifting going on. And that's something we're going to have to address. So if you guys have some comments initially about those questions, and I'd like your testifiers to be thinking about those as they're coming forward, because those are the issues that this committee is going to be concerned about, is this tax shifting that's going on, and why would one class of properties get that benefit over everybody else that's in the jurisdiction. So Senator Latz or Senator Schmidt? Senator
Thank
Latz?
You. Mr. Chairman, I can give you at least a partial answer from my perspective, which is that this will capture certainly some persons or businesses that would remodel anyway. But I think the main target are those that wouldn't be able to afford to invest in their homes to make this kind of remodeling or rehabilitation without this incentive. And those homes are going to remain unimproved, dilapidated in many cases. And to that extent, that harms the property values and the community all around them, too. So if this creates an opportunity for people to financially afford to reinvest in their homes, it will not only catalyze, or in their businesses, it will not only catalyze reinvestment around them, but it will stabilize that housing stock. So the entire community benefits, the other homeowners who would be getting a little bit of a shift, although the revenue department's indication is that the shift is only about half as much as the property tax benefits in the end. Everyone's property values are stronger as a result. Now, how that plays out in an individual's situation is harder to say. But I think you're going to get investments you would not otherwise get. And now, in terms of the last part of your question, I personally am not wedded to any particular mechanism for accomplishing this. I would like to see the financial incentive available to the homeowners and to the commercial industrial property owners to make this reinvestment in their property. And whether it's done through the property taxes or whether it's done through an income tax mechanism or something else, I'm less concerned about that. I know this committee pays very close attention to those questions, and I will respect how the committee wishes to approach that. But in terms of the goal and the outcome, I'd like to see the financial incentive there, because I think it would have a strong benefit for the entire community that's involved.
And Senator Schmidt?
You know, I would just, again, echo what Senator Ladd said to say on this. I think we're looking for more tools in the toolbox, added incentives for investment in homes and in areas that might not otherwise see that investment. So we really do want to focus on those individuals that might not otherwise be improving their homes or their businesses. And I think I tend to take the longer view of this and say after 10 years, what will the property valuations look like because of an incentive program like this? What sort of benefits are going to be passed along to neighborhood investments or property values and the whole property tax base of a community? And I certainly understand the committee's sensitivity to property tax shifts. I share them. But I would hope that you understand what we're trying to get at here in putting another tool in the toolbox and giving folks an opportunity to make investments.
And one other issue that we'll have to address, and that is that these properties, as their values would be increased, would be taken out of the tax capacity for that community. Aids and credits are based on, you know, the ANTC of a community. So at some level, I can understand the city's support for this because, you know, they would get to maintain their aid and credit level, still have the growth in their adjusted net tax capacity with no penalty, you know. So it's like the state would be picking up some of the cost for this community's development. Maybe that's appropriate, but it's certainly something that we'll have to have an ongoing discussion about what we would, you know, what would be the ramifications of that. And Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I represent some first-ring suburbs, Brooklyn Center and Brooklyn Park, who strongly support this bill. We had some devastating losses with the foreclosure movement, and we have a lot of abandoned houses, and this redevelopment of an already totally developed suburb is just imperative to keep our cities going. They're, if you don't keep up the housing stock, you don't get the redevelopment of already developed land. It's really hard to maintain your tax base and to move your city forward.
Thank you, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate the discussion today, and I definitely support and I look forward to hearing to your testifiers about the value of historic preservation in our communities. I think it has a value on a number of levels, and so I'm very glad to see this bill. But I am very concerned about the property tax shift aspect of it. I'm concerned, as I believe the chair mentioned, that we would be actually shifting property taxes onto those who could not even afford to do the upgrades. And so I think there's an issue with the property tax shift aspect of that. And so I have a different alternative, which is the income tax. So having some sort of income tax credits, I think the feds have a 10% historic tax credit, and I'm not sure if that would be a model for us. But I was going to do an amendment to that bill, to this bill today, regarding changing it from a property tax credit to an income tax credit. But it's a little more, there's a lot of moving parts in there, and so it's too much to actually do at this exact moment. But I do hope that this particular initiative moves forward, and I'll be working on trying to get a better mechanism. So I really appreciate the authors both standing by the intent of the bill and the purpose of it, but being flexible in how can we get there in a better manner. And so I will continue to try and get all those moving parts aligned. It sounds like there's a lot of tax committee members who also are interested in a different way to achieve this laudable goal. So thank you.
And Senator Nelson, I would imagine that the authors would be very supportive of this being converted from a property tax shift within their jurisdiction to a tax credit paid for by the state, but I don't think we're going to go there. But you did bring up the question that I think has to be answered, and you mentioned it about the historic buildings. And is a 30-year-old building really truly an historic building? I mean, it was built in 1985. The old home was 45 years, which people were arguing that might not have been an old and long enough time period. Now, I understand that the older the building, the higher the benefits. I get some of that. But anyway, those are issues that we'll have to continue. Senator Latz or Senator Schmidt, did you want to respond also?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do support this. My community supports it. I do have some questions, and it made me think, so I would also like to ask the testifiers to think about this, because I do agree, is this shifting it? And I think we do need to look at it, like Senator Nelson said, is this shifting on to people who can't afford to do the fix? And so are there other programs through economic development, through deed, or I know the city has or had NRP, the city of Minneapolis had that. So are there other mechanisms that we could also do the same thing? Because I do agree that some of these houses in my community and across the city of Minneapolis would really benefit this, and it does improve the neighborhood, which improves the property values and economic vitality of the whole community. So I get the benefit. So I would just like to ask the testifiers if there are any other means to do this and if there are grants out there already. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Artman.
Mr. Chair, I just want to thank the senators for bringing forward new ideas. I think we are all trying to find new ways to help invigorate the economy and secure our communities in different ways, and I think this is one we should consider in the whole scheme of property tax improvements. I wonder, though, the commercial industrial one is problematic for me, but we do have programs like TIF or similar to TIF, and you may want to look at maybe changing the way we do TIF or expanding that or redefining it to include these commercial industrial properties. I hope you'll consider that, maybe taking that out separately and approaching that and maybe seek the guidance of these cities. When it comes to the homestead properties, I see exactly what you're doing, and we do shifts all the time for property taxes. We decide what our priorities are. If we decide we're going to give a property tax relief to veterans or spouses of veterans lost in war, we do those kinds of property shifts. But I think in this case, you might want to consider a referendum. If the community is so convinced that this is the best way to support the property valuations in the community, maybe with the referendum you could get the input and you wouldn't be as worried as Senator Dietzick and Senator Nelson are that the rest of the community doesn't support it. But I would certainly think some way to draw in that community in that decision would be of interest and would help you pass your bill.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions from the committee, we do have a pretty good list of testifiers. I think you two can both stay there. We'll bring them up two at a time. We've got four chairs. Ms. Corcoran, League of Minnesota Cities, and Mr. Gasek. I'm not going to get that right.
Got it right.
Oh, okay. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Heather Corcoran. I'm an IGR, Intergovernmental Relations Liaison with the League of Minnesota Cities. We want to echo the thanks that our two authors gave to the committee for hearing this bill. We're excited for the discussion and appreciate the comments that you've all shared already and the questions and things to consider. From the League's point of view, we've heard from our cities for a while that they're looking for tools to help maintain their housing stock and their Main Street businesses. And this is a familiar one that has experience working in local communities. As you know, when the program previously existed, there was a report from the Department of Revenue in 2004 that stated there were 57,000 properties that utilized it in all but one county. So it's a wide program that's well known in the state. This legislation is designed to provide owners of older homes and businesses an incentive to renovate their property, to preserve it, and revitalize neighborhoods and main streets. And these bipartisan bills have support from the League of Minnesota Cities, Metro Cities, and others that you'll hear from shortly. The legislation is obviously modeled after the previous program that existed for 10 years for this old house and for this old shop, existed from 1997 to 2001. I'm altering my testimony a little bit based on the knowledge that the committee already has on the program. The League's open to using other mechanisms to achieve the public policy goal of revitalizing housing stock and Main Street businesses. So we look forward to working with the authors and members of this committee and the legislature on that in the future. To the chair's question, perhaps on the 30-year mark and why that was changed, we had heard from cities in the past couple of years that, especially communities that have a lot of development that happened in the 1980s, we wanted to be able to have this program allow those communities to be eligible. We also find that we've heard from communities where, you know, houses that are 30 years old, are probably at the point where they're needing some repairs if they haven't been done already, and so it's a good point to look into as a threshold. But we're flexible, again, on a lot of the mechanisms and the particulars to achieve the public policy goal.
Mr. Gasek.
Hi, my name's Doug Gasek, and I am the executive director of the Preservation Alliance of Minnesota, the statewide nonprofit organization dedicated to the preservation of adaptive reuse of historic and established places throughout the state. One of our core programs at the Preservation Alliance is Minnesota Main Street. Main Street is an asset-based economic and community development tool, and we believe in Main Street that community's primary assets are its heritage and its people, and that's what really goes into the Main Street program. Historic downtowns provide a natural incubator for local entrepreneurs. The businesses are central to local economic stability, and historic downtowns communicate the identity of the community. Since 2010, when Main Street reemerged in Minnesota, there are seven communities have been designated throughout the state, from Wilmer to Red Wing, Owatonna, Shakopee, Faribault, and New Ulm. Additionally, there's 30 associate-level communities throughout the state from all parts of Minnesota. In that short amount of time, the Preservation Alliance, we've been able to collect some data to show the impact that Main Street has in communities. In those 4 years, in those seven designated Main Street communities, 155 building rehabs have taken place, representing about $7 million of private investment in our downtowns. Through this concentrated effort, 63 new businesses were created and 210 new jobs were developed in Main Street. Over the past 4 years, we've been able to witness how preservation incentives can make a difference in Minnesota and can create jobs and inspire investment in our communities through the rehabilitation tax credit. In 2013, that tax credit produced 1,200 workers and produced $138 million in preservation output. Since the tax credit began, over 7,500 preservation-related jobs were created. And the reason why so many jobs are created in preservation is that preserving historic properties is more labor-intensive than new construction. Nearly 70% of project budgets for preservation is dedicated to labor, while new buildings rely on 50% labor, 50% new construction. Increased labor results in greater income and sales tax revenues. We've seen great success in the historic tax credit over the years, and the historic tax credit, but the historic tax credit is only available to properties that are listed on the National Register of Historic Places. And to date, there's about 29 commercial historic districts throughout the state, and the majority of our seven Main Street communities do not have historic districts. So that means the great downtowns in Wilmer and Red Wing and Owatonna and Shakopee don't have that tax credit available to them. So most of the buildings wouldn't qualify for the state rehab tax credit. This is why this old house and this old shop is really needed to incentivize building maintenance and rehab in our great downtowns throughout the state. So in short, rehabilitating a historic building is a really powerful act of development that creates jobs and income. Because of the labor intensity of rehab and the relatively high wages for workers, very few industries can create more jobs and household income than preservation. So let's keep encouraging redevelopment of our existing buildings to keep those cores of the community strong. And I'd also like to add to that just a little bit about that 30-year mark again, too. And that what we've really seen in the preservation world is like buildings really need a reinvestment after they've been around about 30 to 35 years because they're starting to deteriorate. So rather than letting them deteriorate to a point where there needs to be a huge reinvestment in the properties, it's really good to have some infusion of capital into buildings around that 30 to 35 year mark. So that's one of the great reasons to have that shifted to that point in time.
But isn't that just part of the cost of operating the business in that building is keeping their business, the building current with what the business needs?
It's part of the business, but it's also part of our greater community to keep those downtowns healthy, to keep them revitalized and operational. As we've seen through a lot of different communities throughout the country, there's a disinvestment sometimes in those downtowns, and those downtowns are truly the heart and soul of our communities. So I think it's a community effort that needs to happen to take place to have reinvestment occur.
I have some sympathy for the downtown that has a large old hotel or some major building that they're trying to maintain the viability of for their downtown. I get that, but I mean, 30 years is not an old commercial industrial building. That's like the remodel of the mall. I just think the time frame for what we're contemplating here is way too short. But anyway, committee members? Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that either of these two questions are for these two witnesses, but for any of the witnesses or maybe the authors at some point. But one of which was, if you've got a house, let's say in a smaller community that's not a high-valued home or something, you put on a $50,000 increase in the value, and then 9 years later you sell it. I'm just curious, does the new buyer, do they have any way of knowing that? Because you look at what the property taxes have been the last few years. Do they have any way of knowing that this is going to jump significantly in the next couple of years? That's one question. I'm not sure if the authors or maybe that's committee staff later. But the other one is just if either these witnesses or the future ones could speak briefly to the, again, I have the newer concept of the this old shop or whatever you're calling it, the CI property. I guess I have more of an interest in how that helps, because I can see how the shift, if my home is in the neighborhood and homes around it are improved, that does help all of our homes. Is the same thing true in CI property? I guess that's not meant for either these two witnesses or the next ones, but somewhere along the line, I guess I'd be curious about that.
Mr. Sylvia.
Mr. Chair and Senator Marty, just to answer the question you had about kind of a notice, if the property is ever sold, transferred, or loses its homestead status, then the value exclusion is added back the subsequent year in which the property was sold or transferred. So it wouldn't necessarily continue on to the next owner. But I know if there's a question about notification, you know, whether the county assessor would have that information. I know there's an application involved, but it would lose the exclusion if it was sold or transferred.
So,
Senator Martin.
Mr. Chair, if I'm buying a home and I think the property tax is going to be $1,500 a year, the day after I buy it, since I lose that this old house exclusion, it could be $1,000 more, perhaps, depending on the situation. And I may not. You're not sure if we would have a notice of that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Marty. I don't believe there's a mechanism that would require any sort of notification other than the initial application procedure with the assessor. But I would assume that whoever is buying the property, I mean, there would be some sort of notification, but it's not specified, at least in text.
Anything else, members? Thank you. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Mornson, city manager from Hopkins, and Ms. Peters. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair, and members of the committee. I'm Mike Mortensen, city manager of Hopkins. We're a city about 13 miles west of the Twin Cities in Hennepin County. We have over 18,000 residents. We have over 300 businesses that employ over 13,000 throughout just in our city. I'm also a board member for the League of Minnesota Cities, and we have a policy committee that's made up of over 150 city members throughout the state that have this as a policy and feel this is important to preserve and maintain housing and commercial stock, not just in the metro area, but throughout the entire state. For Hopkins, there's two things here I just want to stress is if you've been to Hopkins, we take a lot of pride in our Main Street. It's priority number 1, 2, and 3 for our city council, always has been. And we have buildings that were built in 1900 that the developer or their owner sometimes struggles with renovating because it's hard to bring those buildings up to current fire and building codes, whether or not it's going to be a restaurant or some other use that might be sitting vacant. So this would help them maybe offset and put some improvement into the commercial piece. As far as our housing stock, we're fairly unique that 55% of our housing is rental. So we have 45% that's single family. And out of that 45% that single family, we have about 75% that would qualify under the way this is currently written. That's under 400,000 or over 30 years. And I don't know if the 30 years is the right number or not, but that, I'm just telling you that we have a high percentage of housing that would benefit from this. And we did utilize this when it was first started in 93. And it had a trickle effect within neighborhoods where when one neighbor used it, other neighbors used it. And there were some neighbors that probably didn't need it, but they utilized it anyway, and there was other neighbors that were over the threshold. So it kind of created an economic incentive throughout the city. You know, Senator Marty's question on what's the commercial benefit for this, one of the things that we had is the vacant buildings we had, in some cases it was a vacant gas station or a vacant industrial area. When we see renovation there, it really not only increases the value of the neighborhood, but it takes care of some crime issues because vacancy creates blight and individuals that hang out there. So there's kind of a secondary benefit besides the valuation. So we really kind of rank our vacant commercial industrial buildings as a high priority too. So, you know, we would benefit. I think a lot of cities in the state would benefit. And I want to thank you, Chair and Committee, and Senator Latz for sponsoring this bill.
Mr. Morrison, did you, after the bill or the legislation expired, did you ever contemplate just putting a little local levy on and having some grants that you would provide to these structures that would basically accomplish the same thing? I mean, it would do the same mechanism without any state legislation. Have you contemplated that?
We actually do that right now through our relationship with Hennepin County. We have actually a revolving loan fund and a grant fund dependent upon the income that gets utilized every year to continue the renovation of some of our older homes.
Oh, very good.
So
there is a mechanism in place to accomplish some of this.
There is, but it depends on what part of the state you're living in. I think Hennepin County and Ramsey County probably have two of the more progressive counties that have those type of housing rehab programs. I can't speak for the other 85 counties throughout the state.
Thank you. Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Morrison, thank you. Do you think that if you put this on the ballot, it would pass your community with a vote of support?
Mr. Morrison.
Chair, Senator, I think it probably would, but I don't know if our council would feel comfortable putting something like this on the ballot. I'm just not, you know, this is something that a city council would have to have a discussion on, but I personally think in our city it would probably pass. I'm not so sure it would pass in a lot of other cities.
Mr. Chair,
Sarah.
What I'm thinking is that communities are all so different. You know, you just don't know whether Chaska would do it or not do it. Chanhassen wouldn't have a need for it. Hopkins community might very much value this type of program. And the idea of engaging the community in the council proceedings and open meetings and a full and open discussion of it seems to me to have an awful lot of benefit. And so I'd hope that you would consider that moving forward.
Mr. Peters.
Thank you, Chairman Skoll and members of the committee. My name is Andrew Peters. I sit on the City Council for the City of Lake City, the birthplace of water skiing. Our community is a small rural city located in Lake Pepin, which is part of the Mississippi River system in southeastern Minnesota with an approximate population of 5,000 year-round residents. Our city has a good manufacturing and business base with the top 10 business entities employing 2,131 people or 43% of our population. What we are experiencing is that 65% of these workers choose to live outside the city of Lake City because of perceived high housing costs, high rental costs, and not earning a high enough salary to afford these residents. I've talked with many real estate firms in our community. They're indicating they entertain many prospective buyers who want to purchase or move into a home, reasonably priced home in our city, with little or no upgrade cost. Basically, it's a turnkey. They move in and boom, and they go on living. We have many residences available at very low cost, but to make these homes to a perceived livable condition for young buyers and retirees will take too much money to upgrade, and thus the building becomes out of reach for affordability and remains empty. And we do have, when I was campaigning some years back, I count over 200 empty homes with no for sale signs or no foreclosure signs. They're just sitting idle. As you are well aware, older homes in need of improvement have lower assessed values than newer homes that are ready to move into. Many young families or retirees cannot afford higher prop tax assessments, nor have funds to improve the residents for livability. Thus, they look elsewhere. This then makes finding qualified workers for our locally businesses more difficult because they have to reach out to other areas in southeastern Minnesota and in western Wisconsin for workers who are already established in those communities who will not move. The community loses out on potential property tax revenues, utility revenues, and also impacts our school district. And we have a reduction in children headcount because we will lose the young families. We have a great education system, so that's impacted. We also have numerous empty storefronts with buildings built 100 plus or more years in great need of much repair, upgrade, becoming ADA compliant, modernizing interiors, utility upgrades, of which most potential buyers will stay away from. And talking with real estate people, in addition, when people come in to look at existing businesses that are up for sale, they'll look at the neighboring business and they said, why would I want to open a business when I've got a blighted property, which is going to deter visitors, prospective buyers that come in our community. Our city of our size for economic development needs many tools in our toolbox to have available to apply and encourage prospective business owners and residents to move into our small river town. I sit on the EDA board, and we have many tools, but for any given scenario, you cannot use more than one or two of the 19 that are available in any condition. So we want to have a wide variety of financial tools and incentives to restore our community and get people to come into our community. So I urge all of you to support Senate File 319 and 208 to allow small rural cities to have another tool in their financial incentive toolbox to make the community more desirable to live and work in. Thank you for the privilege to speak to you.
Thank you, Mr. Peters. Questions for these two gentlemen? Seeing none, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Doherty and Mr. Koulas. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Doherty.
Thank you. Thank you for having us here today. I'm here from Wilmer, Minnesota, that has a host of lovely buildings. Older buildings need more extensive and expensive repairs and are often left in disrepair to only continue to decline, create eyesores, and become impossible to renovate for a new use. Older buildings, whether they are historical or just part of our story, are a terrific investment in the future. They are already in place, services are in place, infrastructure is in place. What happens often is the building is sold, if it is sold at all, for a ridiculously low price to a buyer who doesn't have money to repair and renovate properly, so the building continues to decline. Let me give you a case history of the Lakeland Hotel in downtown Wilmer, our most significant remaining 1920s hotel in our railroad history town. I work for the Wilmer Design Center, now Wilmer Downtown Development. My nonprofit organization did everything we could to make sure this hotel could be a shining star of an outstanding building. We raised the funds to get the hotel on the National Historic Register and succeeded. We raised the funds to redesign the second and third floors into one- and two-bedroom apartments. Currently, there are small single rooms with shared bathrooms and showers. The first floor would have been a new retail space. We found a stellar developer who found a way to finance the improvements needed, including roof, HVAC, electrical, elevator updates, plus the housing renovation to meet the needs of the 21st century. We could not get a tax abatement to make the costs cash flow. Look what we missed. New attractive retail on the main corner of downtown Wilmer, new and functional living spaces downtown, a building of outstanding brickwork with designation on the National Register. This is what we got. Purchased by a buyer with no interest in the historical significance. Second and third floors were left the same as they were in the 1920s. It's a flop house. No major repairs, no roof, no electrical or HVAC, an elevator still in disrepair. What will it be? Here's what we're doing now. We changed our name to reflect what we do. We partnered with the Preservation Alliance of Minnesota on their Fix-It program, so that we would have control this time over the ownership of the building. The 8,000-square-foot building was scheduled to be torn down right in the middle of downtown, in the middle of the block. What will this building be? A food hub for aggregation and value-added processing for local foods, a commercial teaching kitchen with a chef for local food meals, 2 incubator smaller kitchens to launch food businesses with locally grown foods, a craft beer establishment. All spaces are leased with a waiting list, and we have only begun the renovation. We have at least 10 more buildings that need to get into the right hands and have tax abatement available so owners can afford to make the big improvements to make the buildings sustainable for the future. Renovation means jobs. Our business plan for this building says that we will gain 25 new jobs in the middle of downtown Wilmer within 5 years. Included in that is an expanded central business district, which includes many housing opportunities for people who come to me once a week and say, where is there a nice place to live downtown? What will happen to the Lakeland? We will watch it fall apart due to neglect unless the current owner gives it up, and the cost to renovate will be even larger.
Ms. Daugherty, so the local boards wouldn't vote for the abatement, or I'm not tracking why you didn't receive the tax abatement.
Because in many small towns, your local government does not understand the value of what's sitting right in front of them.
Okay, thank you. A handwritten note on your name, so you'll have to.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Senator Dietzick.
Thank you. Can I just ask you, did you qualify or did you look at getting any grants to help do the renovation?
Of the Lakeland
Ms.
Hotel?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we had several grants. That's how we got it on the National Register. That's how we paid for the design fees.
Okay, so then you just.
Senator Dietzick.
It just didn't go any further because still had a gap.
The developer couldn't make it work.
Okay.
That was the last piece to put in place was tax abatement.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Cronin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Daugherty, I just wanted to let everybody know that what they're doing, Wilmer, is really quite impressive. And I can see where what this bill does would really help Wilmer and other communities, I'm sure, too. That question of tax abatement, why that wasn't done locally, that's always an interesting question. And a lot of times it just depends upon the particular makeup of the council at the time. And that can shift from time to time. And so the timing of these projects and who happens to be serving on the council at the time can be an issue, too. But anyway, thank Ms. Daugherty for coming to the committee today.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Senator Cronin. Mr. Coolis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Chad Coolis, and I'm here today representing the Building Jobs Coalition. The Building Jobs Coalition was created in 2009 to advocate for growing jobs in Minnesota through design and construction of commercial, industrial, residential, and institutional projects. We have members representing contractors, unions, architects, engineers, economic developers, and more, who all believe in the common goal to bring the construction industry back to a healthy level by helping create jobs for unemployed and underemployed in vertical construction. Every year, the Building Jobs Coalition creates a legislative platform, which is distributed to all legislators. We have had many successes over the years, including the 2010 Jobs Bill, which included many of our priorities. Our platform has also included several projects found in bonding bills, support for economic development programs, pro-building industry regulation and permitting policies, positive taxation incentives, and infrastructure and asset preservation. Another item that has been in our platform for many years is support to reauthorize the This Old House tax abatement program. Reasons for this support of the program include preservation jobs have a greater percentage of the budget dedicated to labor compared to new projects, leading to greater income and sales tax revenue. Private investment in historic properties will increase throughout the state, putting more neglected properties back on the tax rolls. This legislation will be a great help to business owners that work in residential properties, and this version of the bill will affect more projects since it is geared to properties that are over 30 years instead of the previous legislation, which was over 45 years. So again, the Building Jobs Coalition, which is to go on record in support of Senate File 208. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions, members? Seeing none, thank you very much. Mr. May, and then from the department, I have a number of names. I don't know who's coming up from the department. Mr. Kotzheim? Mr. Cummings?
Let's keep to that. Yeah.
We'll start with Mr. May. Welcome to the committee. Is that okay? Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair Skoy, members of the committee, I apologize. I need to leave in order to give comment to a bill in the House. Our assistant director for the property tax division is here, John Clockstein, with any follow-up questions about this old house.
Sure, sure.
Mr. Chair, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the tax policy manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Yesterday, I talked to Senators Latz and Skoy. I used to live in Red Wing. Senator Schmidt.
We spoke, too.
Yeah, I talked to Senator Schmidt. I used to live in Red Wing. There's lots of beautiful homes, and I've been out to Hopkins many times. So this bill would bring back a policy of basing our property tax system on a system of value judgments that would not be based on market value. We currently have many tools to recognize behaviors or situations in the tax code, including various class rates, credits, aids, and refunds. But as you know, many instruments within the tax system are blunt instruments, you know, and this seems to be another blunt instrument. The proposal would exclude part of value from market value for homes or businesses. So this old house, limited market value, were examples of programs that seem to distort the market place by placing values on properties that are not linked to market value. In most, if not all cases, this old house would increase the market value homestead exclusion, then again creating another element within the property tax system. So this old house would impact the market value exclusion, which would again change the market value of one home for the purpose of assessment. I know the original intent of this old house was to keep historic homes from being raised, and I know this is being brought up, and many testifiers have talked about other elements too. It was also used for other purposes. Many times we would hear about central air conditioning being put in and then being able to receive this exclusion. Just wanted to say that as this proposal gets moved forward right now, we're trying to think about how this would be administered. We have our limited capabilities in terms of the phase-in provision. It would be very difficult to compute and correctly calculate the phase-in of the excluded value. We're also trying to figure out properties that had multiple improvements or updates, how those exclusion start dates would work out. There would be multiple dates of review and phase-in for the exclusion. We're also trying to think through the interaction that this would have for local government aid. One of the elements for local government aid is pre-1940 housing. And so how would this impact that? We're still trying to think through that. So this would something that would require us to have additional education, fact sheets, memos, and bulletins. We look forward to continuing to work with the authors, Senators Latz and Schmidt, and you, Mr. Chair, if this is something that continues to be move forward in the committee process.
And Mr. Cummings, so the bill benefits the value increase due to the remodel or construction or whatever. If you put a new roof on a building, is that a value increase that would qualify? I mean, you mentioned HVAC. How, and maybe Mr. May would be the better one to ask this of, but how are we going to determine what exactly the remodel has accomplished as part of the value? And, you know, maybe we should just turn to Mr. May now. But that's my question here, is how are we going to, you put on another room, I can see that value change, but on the rest of these proposals, redoing the siding or redoing the roof or putting on an air conditioner. What do the assessors do when they're adjusting value for that? And thank you, Mr. Cummings. We'll turn to the department. Mr. May.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom May. I'm the retired Hennepin County assessor, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers, MAAO, as we call it. The association is opposed to Senate File 208 and Senate File 319, And we've been opposed to this legislation since 1993, so we haven't changed our opinion at any point. Each year, MAO prepares a position statement for the legislative session. You have a copy in front of you, I believe. And if you look at item 2, A, B, and C, it states some of the things that we believe in as far as the property tax system. MAO believes adjustments to market values, such as limitations on assessors' estimated market values, acquisition values, deferments, exclusions, or exemptions, creates inequities between taxpayers. MAO supports good tax policy that treats all taxpayers in a consistent manner. MAO opposes classifications or programs that target only a small number of taxpayers. MAO encourages the continued use of state-administered programs such as the Property Tax Refund Program, Special Targeted Refunds, the Income Tax System, etc., if policymakers wish to grant additional tax relief. That sums up MAO's position on bills of this nature. The Property Tax Working Group that all of you are familiar with actually did a comprehensive study of our property tax system in 2011 through 2012. They issued a final report in November of 2012, and some of the things on that report are very enlightening and guiding in this regard. One of their guiding principles in that report was base property taxes on market value. Using a value other than full estimated market value by applying exclusions, limitations, or alternate values creates confusion, complexity, costs, and distortions. Also, one of their guiding tenets was that the system should be simple and transparent, and this should be made a priority. A transparent and understandable system facilitates trust and accountability. A simple system is more efficient and reduces errors, unintended outcomes, and high costs. Policymakers must defend these important principles. They also had 19 recommendations that they included in the report. And if you go to number 18 on that report, they talk about special valuations and deferrals. Their opinion was these programs increase complexity and decrease efficiency, transparency, and accountability, impose sunset dates on all current and future programs to prompt review. And, of course, as we know, this old house is now in its sunset mode up until 2018. In addition, the International Association of Assessing Officers prepares tax policy standards that are used throughout the world. On that tax policy standard, one of the things they talk about is limits that constrain changes in assessed or appraised value. They say that property may appear to provide control, but actually distort the distribution of the property tax, destroying property tax equity, increasing public confusion and administrative complexity. The Department of Revenue, back when this old house was in its run before the phase-out, they always prepared a report annually that told us about this old house and the impacts. The last one they prepared was in 2004, and the findings in there were that across the state, and I think Senator Scori already mentioned this, there was over $700 million of exclusion from this old house alone. And this represented 56,940 parcels across the state. So it's not a small program. It's a very complex program when you apply it across all the assessors in the state. We're concerned about the shifting. Of course, it's been talked about. Those who can afford to make an improvement, of course, get the benefit. Possibly their neighbors who can't afford to make an improvement get to pay a little extra because the tax shifts on them. I would say that if we look at this bill and we really look at the numbers, it's got a $5,000 limit to qualify. And if you look at $5,000 of market valuation and you apply that around the state, we know effective tax rates are different across the state, but a 1% tax rate, that's actually $50. I think it costs more than that to administer the program. If you look at a 1.5% tax rate, it's $75. And if you go up to a $20,000 improvement, it's $200 or $300. And I think that what assessors feel is that this is really not an incentive to do the improvement. The bigger component is really affordability. I would believe their interest rate on their loans would be much more than they'd ever save in property taxes by a long shot. To answer Senator Scoey's question on improvements, things like roofs, typically are maintenance items or paint or those kind of things. Unless the homeowner would take an older roof and put dormers and do something, you know, exquisite with doing that, there would be improvements added. But typically those are maintenance and really, in most cases, don't add value.
And so, Mr. May, so you've got a rundown house and you fix it up by putting new paint and shingles and windows in. Has it increased the value of the home?
Senator Scoia, members of the committee, there possibly could be. It depends if the assessor has taken into account the condition and depreciated it for those items. And now on a review after those items are improved, the effective age would, of course, increase, the depreciation would decrease, and the value would increase by that. I'm not sure that all those would be actual improvement amounts, though they would be more of a decrease of depreciation on that particular property.
And, Mr. May, so the assessor's going down the street, and there's a house on one side of the street that's been through this program and has a value exclusion, and the one on the other side of the street's almost identical but has not been through this program. How does the assessor deal with those two differences? Does one homeowner pay more tax and the other one doesn't? And how do you work through that?
The one that has the improvement that qualifies under this old house, of course, would have a lesser value. And I assume you're saying they're identical now. And so the person across the street without qualifying for this old house would pay higher tax because, of course, whenever we exclude value from the tax rolls, the tax rate increases to make up for the loss in the tax base. So the tax increase on the one across the house would it'd be more than he would normally pay if it wasn't this old house involved. And I would say this, that the benefit of this old house probably is watered down by the decrease in the tax base across the whole jurisdiction and the increase in the tax rate that ensues.
Thank you. Senator Marty?
Mr. Chair, related to your question, I'm curious because I'm just curious how assessors deal with this. If I have a house, mine's 40 years old or so, if we replace the roof and siding and other things just because the old stuff wore out, you replace it, those are just repairs and so on, so they do not change the assessed value. I guess I wonder because if we and our next door neighbors, one of us keeps repairing it and the other one, the house is falling apart, at a certain point that obviously has to change the assessment. But one thing like a roof or a HVAC system or something doesn't necessarily change it, even if it's a $10,000 roof or something?
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, I would say that in each of those cases, it depends. It depends on where that property has been, where it is now, and so forth. But just replacing an existing, asphalt shingle roof with a new asphalt shingle roof doesn't necessarily increase the value because we've probably taken into consideration it's got an adequate asphalt shingle roof in our valuation.
Any other questions, members? Anybody else would like to testify for or against these two Senate files? Senator Martin.
And Mr. Chair, one thing I just figured maybe Senate counsel could respond because Mr. Silvio looked up, answered my question earlier, and apparently it's not issue of homeowners being deceived when they're buying a home. So.
Mr. Silvia.
Mr. Chair and Senator Marty and members, there is in Statute 273.11, Subdivision 18, which references that if a home is covered by the this old house provision, no seller of that property can offer to sell or sell the property without providing notification to the person buying it that this exclusion exists and that upon sale or transfer of the home that exclusion would no longer be in effect.
So, Mr. Chair, it seems there would not be any deception problem. It's already been taken care of.
Anything else, members?
So, Mr. Chair, Schmidt. We had a testifier join the table late.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Chair, my name is John Kloxim. I'm the Assistant Director for the Property Tax Division at Minnesota Revenue. And I would just like to add a couple things to supplement Paul Cummings' testimony.
Mr. Kloxim. Not pronouncing that right, I'm sure.
Mr. Chair, in addition to what Paul Cummings testified on, We have noticed over the first go-around with this program that there were some administrative hurdles that we had to administer as part of property tax, and the assessors had to as well. As you know, this is a long timeline on this program. In fact, most of the participants will be in the program at least 15 years. And if they do multiple projects, it could be more than that. In addition, Mr. Mays spoke about cost not necessarily equaling value. And so there could be a misconception between what participants think they're going to qualify for and what the assessor actually qualifies them for under this program.
To that point, so somebody spends $20,000 and think they're going to get benefit on the entire amount, they might only receive $8,000 of value increase on their home.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. The exclusion is based off of the assessor's discretion as to what this adds in market value.
Continue.
And I just wanted to point out, Mr. Chair, that we have had some administrative bulletins that we've had to issue as to what qualifies, what is a two-car garage, what is maintenance, and things of that nature that make the program not as clear as it could be.
Thank you. Thank you. Anything else, Senator Schmidt, Senator Latz?
Mr. Chairman, I would only add, you know, Senator Ortman has is not in the room at the moment, but if there was any inclination to consider any kind of a local approvals, I would encourage the committee to consider it to be approvals by a local governing body rather than going to referendum.
Well, and Senators, I think we've got some work to do before we're going to move forward with this, but, you know, I sent some support on the committee for the concept, so let's keep working on this. We've got time this session now, and we'll see where we end up at the end of the year. Seeing nothing else, Senate File 319 and Senate File 208 are laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you both very much. Members, there will be a meeting next week on Tuesday. The department's energy tax study is out, so we will be hearing from the department on that. We'll take a look at our schedule to see if we add some bills at the end of that presentation or not.
How about the division?
Property Tax Division is meeting tomorrow. Thank you very much. Committee's adjourned.